More foster kids sleeping in state offices. Efforts to deal with a crisis in the state's child welfare system still failing hundreds of young Texans. That story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Concerns about a growing mental health crisis on the border. We'll hear the latest. Also, disorder in the court. A special panel now asking whether judges in Texas should still run for election in partisan races, or if it's better to follow the federal system of appointment. Also, real brisket, fake news. Texas Monthly's barbecue editor on Texans with a beef about a unique branch of journalism. All those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 21st day of January 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Still getting used to writing 2020 instead of 2019. You know, this new year was supposed to be something of a new start for one of the most beleaguered programs in the Lone Star State. Only a couple of days ago, the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services rolled out new internal guidelines to cut the caseloads of foster care workers overwhelmed on the front lines. You may recall a few years back, conditions for hundreds of kids caught up in the child welfare system were found to be so deficient that a federal judge ruled the system to be unconstitutionally dangerous. There were stories of caseworkers failing to follow up on red flags concerning kids potentially in danger, deaths attributed to deficiencies in case reports, massive turnover in frontline staff, and even young people sleeping in state offices because of a difficulty of finding them beds. Well, now Julie Chang, investigative reporter for the Austin American-Statesman, reports despite repeated efforts by lawmakers to deal with the problems facing Texas's child welfare system, the numbers of kids sleeping in state offices and temporary shelters has actually gone up compared to the previous year. In other words, things seem to be getting worse, not better. Julie, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we've been hearing these stories about foster kids staying in state offices, hotels, other temporary housing. You report that it spiked last year compared to the year before. By how much and why?
Yes. So last year, the monthly count of foster care children who did not have a home for at least two nights totaled 678. And that's a 49% increase from 2018, according to state data. Some of the reasons why these children, who are mostly teens, slept in state offices and other temporary housing include the fact that they are more difficult cases. These teenage kids have significant behavioral issues, and that's what state officials are telling me. They have significant trauma histories, significant mental health needs, and they need specialized beds, specialized placements. And those are some of the foster beds that are in shortage right now.
Forgive me for interrupting, but just so that we understand the structure of this, is it that the state doesn't have the facilities, or that the facilities that the state has are overcrowded, or what exactly?
It's that the facilities that the state doesn't have, right? There is a shortage of foster beds, and there is a little bit of also the state is not adequately tracking beds as well, and the state is actively trying to fix that, making it more automated and inputting beds in the system in a computerized system so that they can better track beds. Because there were beds in previous years that were not used. They just didn't know that they were available, according to a state report recently.
Here's something that I think a lot of listeners can't understand. Each kid, presumably, is assigned a caseworker. That child, that young person, has somebody who is following their, tracking their case. Why is it not known every day where that person is going to be sleeping? I mean, isn't that that seems to me a pretty solid way to track where every person is going to be sleeping, a way to keep up with it. Something is falling through the cracks here.
And I think that is something that state officials are probably recognizing, and that's why they are developing this computerized portal where they can better track foster beds as well as the needs of foster kids so that they can better match them with placements more immediately.
Well, now, I know that state lawmakers have been focused on this. They approved a whole lot of measures that were meant to reform the state's foster care system after a series of reports by the Statesman, the Dallas Morning News, and others. There was a turmoil over caseworker pay, and in fact, this issue that you're reporting on, young people sleeping in state offices. Did all that effort go for naught? I mean, why is it that this is a persistent problem?
So I think the state hasn't quite pinpointed the way to tackle this. And I think that they are testing out strategies. I think one of the things that they are attempting to really solve this issue is by implementing what is called community-based foster care, where they have local nonprofits and local governmental agencies administrate foster care services so that these local entities have a better idea of what the needs are locally. And part of their working with the state involves building the number of foster beds available in those local areas. And so the state is really banking on the idea that community-based foster care will tackle the issue finally.
I wish we had more time to discuss this, but you can check out her story, Julie Chang's story, at our website, texasstandard.org. Julie Chang is an investigative reporter for the Austin American Statesman. Julie, thank you so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on The Standard.
Thank you so much.
How Texas chooses its judges is under review again. This time, an appointed state panel is looking at the practice of electing judges in partisan elections. Joining us to talk about this is Ross Ramsey, executive editor and co-founder of the Texas Tribune, texastribune.org. Welcome back to The Standard, Ross. Always good to talk with you.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
So this seems to have been a topic discussed every few years, a whole lot of deja vu going on here. Who's looking at this process now and why? What is this appointed state panel?
Well, they're looking at the process of how we select our state judges. As you say, this has been going for a long time. The judges would like to get out of partisan elections. They would like to get out of fundraising. In large part, it seems unseemly for a judge. And in practical terms, the people who are most likely to give money to judicial campaigns or people with business before the court. So there's all kinds of sort of inherent problems there. And chief justices of the Texas Supreme Court have had this as a staple of their state of the judiciary speeches for the last quarter century. It's hard to get legislative attention, but now, you know, we have a former Supreme Court judge in the governor's mansion. We have a legislature that's willing to look at this, if a little reluctantly, we can come back to that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the issue kind of has resurfaced. I don't know whether it's actually going to go anywhere. There's a lot of risk for legislators here, but it's interesting that they're talking.
There was a really terrific book that I'd encourage anyone to read. It's called The People's Courts Pursuing Judicial Independence in America. And it was written, I think it was published back in 2012 or so, but it talks about this difficulty in balancing these two competing pressures. On the one hand, you have judicial accountability, which is this notion that, you know, judges need to be sensitive to popular and political pressures, accountability. But then you have this other side, and that's judicial independence, which means that judges should pay attention to the rule of law and not where they're getting their election funds from, right? So it seems to me that what Texas has decided here is that in the interest of accountability, that is to say that the judges are in keeping with the spirit of the people, that we're going to elect our judges.
Right.
And that's sort of, that's been what, the standard since our beginning, no? Something like that?
This is how we've done it. You know, we elect our judges, you know, and at the time the Constitution was written for the state, and, you know, politics was a smaller world. You had a better chance of the people voting, knowing the people they were voting for. Now we're in an age where if you're in a big county, you know, if you're in Harris County, Texas, or Dallas, or Travis, or Bear, the ballots are pages and pages and pages long. And one of the arguments here is that voters don't have enough information about all of the people, particularly as you get further and further down the ballot, to make wise decisions.
Isn't the fear, I mean, if we cut right to the bone, isn't the fear that judges are going to rule in favor of, say, big developers who give their campaigns money?
This is the problem with any kind of picking mechanism. However you pick judges, it's subjective. If I appoint judges, I'm likely to appoint judges that I think see the law the same way I do. There's a bias built into that. If I elect judges, you've got the combination of donor influence, of voter influence, of judges looking at, you know, the best way to get into office as opposed to necessarily the best thing to do once you're in office. You have to trust them at some level. It's subjective at some level. You just have to decide which kind of system you want to hold your nose for.
So what does that mean for this appointed state panel that's looking at the practice of electing judges here in Texas?
It's risky for legislators because they're asking voters, do you want us to take away one of your rights?
Yeah,
like judges?
Right.
This was seen in the comments from Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick very early on, who said, you know, I'm not sure that's really a good idea. I'm not sure that's something voters want us to do. I've seen polls over the years, nothing recent, that suggested the same thing. It's kind of an uphill climb for legislators, and I think a lot of them look at it and say, I have less to gain here than I have potentially to lose. I'd just as soon change the subject.
Ross Ramsey, executive editor and co-founder of the Texas Tribune. We'll link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Ross, good to talk with you again, sir.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
Joining us once again in the studio, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. What are you seeing out there, Wells?
Hi, David. Well, we're hearing from folks about the story at the start of the show, how the number of Texas foster youth sleeping in offices and hotels last year rose almost 50% over the previous year. On our Facebook page, Kim Seicher asks, what can be done to increase the number of people who would be willing to open their homes to these children on a temporary basis? People like herself who might not be interested in being a full-time foster parent, but would be willing to help out temporarily. Pardon me. Kim writes, we could draw from a pool of already vetted individuals such as teachers, school volunteers, police, CASA volunteers, and daycare center employees, CASA being a group that works with children. We are also hearing from folks about the story we just shared, the Texas practice of judicial elections and whether there is a better way out there. And speaking of courts, the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump getting underway today. Lots of reactions about those topics and more. So I will be back sharing some of those reactions later in the broadcast.
You know it. Of course, he'd love to hear from you so we can share your comments with everybody. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar looking for you. He'll be back in about 35 minutes or so with more of the talk of Texas. And the Standard continues in just a moment. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at TexasChildrens.org.
Hi, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. By now, you've likely heard that thousands of migrants are camped out in Mexican border towns waiting for asylum hearings in the United States. There are stories of squalor and dangerous conditions in those camps. And as Texas Public Radio's Reynaldo Leaños Jr. reports, growing concerns about a mental health crisis. A special note here, the story you're about to hear includes graphic details.
Hundreds of tents are scattered around the international bridge that connects Brownsville, Texas to Matamoros, Mexico, where more than 2,000 asylum seekers are living. Kelly Escobar has been volunteering with the group that provides supplies and assistance to the migrants.
I've seen mental health declining rapidly, especially with people being denied asylum.
Escobar left her home in Ohio because she wanted to help the migrants.
At first, everybody was hopeful. They had dreams, hopes, and thought there was a possibility of asylum. And you just see it in people's faces. You see the despair and the depression.
That despair was on display for the world to see earlier this month when a Mexican asylum seeker killed himself on an international bridge about 60 miles away. He had just been denied entry into the U.S., according to Mexican investigators. Escobar says she's heard from a lot of migrants who are struggling.
They'll call me at midnight, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'll stay on the phone with them for hours just trying to calm the situation down. And there's no psychological or no therapist. There's nobody here that helps these people in that aspect.
U.S. officials say they are working with Mexico to improve services for the migrants, but aid groups say there are little to no mental health care for asylum seekers up and down the border. In Matamoros, immigrant advocates are trying to get mental health experts to come to the encampment. Ariana Sawyer with Human Rights Watch has visited the town and others like it.
We're talking about people who've expressed to me that they're experiencing anxiety, depression, nightmares, night terrors, things like that. And especially, I think, for children, these are going to be long-lasting problems and traumas that they are going to have to deal with.
The Trump administration has made many changes to the asylum system, making it extremely difficult to get protection here. And while they wait for their day in U.S. immigration court, the migrants are forced to wait in Mexico. The administration says the new system is more efficient, but Sawyer says the administration had another goal.
This policy was designed to traumatize asylum seekers further to the point where they become willing to give up on their asylum claims. And it is doing just that.
Roberto Gonzalez fled violence in Honduras with his two boys. He says he's not giving up on his asylum claim just yet. But he did get so desperate that he sent his two sons across the border by themselves. Gonzalez knew that was the only way they'd be allowed in. The U.S. doesn't turn away unaccompanied children.
They would tell me, "Dad, no, Dad, no." They'd say, "Please don't. Don't let us go. Please, Dad, we love you." I tell them it's going to be better for the both of you.
He says at times there was no food for his kids at the camp. He also says his boys had trouble sleeping and cried all the time. Gonzalez says he too has cried every night since he sent his children across the bridge.
I've gotten into tough mental headspaces where I've gotten thoughts about not wanting to live anymore because I can't be sent back to my country. I know what awaits me if I return. But I ask God to give me strength.
Gonzalez won't see his sons anytime soon. His next asylum hearing is next month.
I'm Reynaldo Leanius Jr. in Matamoros.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. As you're probably aware, journalism has been in something of a decline in recent decades, the rise of the internet undercutting the economic foundation of more than a few newspapers and magazines. Those that survive and still thrive often tailor to specialized tastes. Take the venerable Texas Monthly, which is so very Texan, it appointed Daniel Vaughn as the nation's first and, to our knowledge, still one and only barbecue editor in March 2013. But passions run high in Texas barbecue circles, and Vaughn concedes he occasionally faces a challenge common to the world of journalism, a crisis of confidence, especially from those who feel he's been unfair.
People's feelings do get hurt, both restaurant owners but I'm certainly hear from barbecue fans of a particular place a lot more than I hear from owners.
Well, that's just it. I mean, if I really like barbecue, I sort of feel like I identify a little bit with that particular barbecue place, and I like to show my friends and tell my friends about it and that sort of thing. And then here comes Daniel Vaughn saying that my place isn't as good as, say, Y or Z.
Yeah, but there's a certain rooting interest I think a lot of people have in their local barbecue joint, that they root for it like a sports team. They really love it, and there's nothing else that's any better, and how dare you say that mine's not very good.
But that suggests a certain objectivity about barbecue that may or may not exist. I mean, you would agree, certainly. I mean, that the taste of barbecue is fundamentally a subjective experience.
Yes, and I describe to people all the time, or make sure that people understand, that when I am saying that this is a place that's fantastic, if you have not agreed with me in the past about my barbecue tastes, you're probably not going to agree with me about this new opinion either.
You know, once upon a time in the early days of rock and roll, DJs, they loved to spin certain records that they really fell in love with, until, of course, a scandal erupted.
Hey, I know where you're going here. There is no such thing as barbecue payola. There's no such thing as food critic payola either.
Really?
From any of the food critics I know.
Can you say that completely categorically?
For any of the honest food critics that I know, like any of the big name food critics, mm-hmm. like their career would be over if they took money from a place. Now, I will tell you that I did once get a check from a barbecue joint.
You got a check from a barbecue joint?
I did, yes. I got a cashier's check. And if you know anything about a cashier's check, that's not a check, it's cash, right?
Were they hoping to get a good review from you? Was that
Well, this is the strange thing. It was a place that I'd already written nice things about in the past. And this was a way of thanking me, a really improper way of thanking me. So I had to take a photo of that cashier's check. Uh-huh. I sent an email to my editor. And the fact that I did receive this, I have to go cash it now because it's actual cash. Like, this is money.
You have to cash it?
And then I have to drive it over to this barbecue joint several hours away and hand deliver it back to them.
So you have to document the whole thing.
And tell them to never do this again.
But, I mean, when you think about it, fortunes can rise and fall based on what you write about. That's a lot of weight on your shoulders there, Daniel.
Yeah, I guess so. I think more often fortunes can rise if I really like a place. If a place is popular, especially amongst locals, and I don't like it, those locals aren't going to stop going there. Their core customer base isn't going to stop going there.
But you know what else isn't going to stop? People are not going to stop suspecting that you are saying nice things about this place because, you know, somebody paid you to.
Oh, yeah, especially like in the case of an HEB where I liked the True Texas Barbecue locations. I think just because it's a big company, and how could a big company be doing good barbecue in the minds of a lot of the readers, there was this immediate backlash about the fact that I must be getting paid, or this was in return for some advertising at the magazine, or personally I'm getting a check from HEB. So it's funny, like, as soon as you praise a place that is so well known or maybe such a big corporation like that, there's immediate suspicions.
But none of it's true.
None of it's true. I mean, I go into barbecue joints unannounced. That's the only way I go eat. The barbecue joints, there's a lot of owners, a lot of meat cutters who might recognize me, but certainly none of them knew I was coming.
So beware barbecue joints new and old, because that may be Daniel Vaughn sitting incognito at that corner table. He's barbecue editor for Texas Monthly. Read all his reviews, good and bad, at TexasMonthly.com. Daniel, thanks for letting us peek behind the curtain.
You bet. Oh, and the check's in the mail.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. North Texas Congressman John Ratcliffe says charges of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress against President Trump don't stand a chance in the U.S. Senate. Last night, the White House named the Heath Republican as one of 8 U.S. representatives serving in an advisory role for Trump during his impeachment trial in the upper chamber. Ratcliffe told Fox News Channel today he helped prepare the defense's oral arguments set for later this week.
On a level playing field, it's going to get ugly. I expect a short trial, no witnesses, an early acquittal for President Trump.
Last week, former Baylor University President Kenneth Starr joined the president's legal defense team. Houston Congresswoman Sylvia Garcia is serving as an impeachment manager for House Democrats. Early voting is underway for special runoff elections to fill 3 seats in the Texas House of Representatives. As KERA's Eric Austin reports, one of the races is in Dallas County.
Dallas Mayor Eric Johnson used to represent Texas House District 100. He stepped down from the state legislature last year after he was elected to his current post. Whoever replaces Johnson will also be a member of the Democratic Party. The special election runoff is between Democrats James Armstrong III and Lorraine Birabel. There are 2 other contests to fill vacant seats in the Texas House. Both of those are in the Houston area. Election day is next Tuesday, January 28th.
Eric Austin reporting. The U.S. Navy is naming an aircraft carrier after a World War II sailor from Texas. As Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner reports, it's the first time an African American has received the honor.
Waco Congressman Bill Flores says ship cook Doris Miller is a hometown hero and deserves to have the USS Doris Miller named for him. Flores spoke during a Martin Luther King Jr. ceremony Monday recognizing great African Americans.
During the attack on Pearl Harbor and while under heavy enemy fire, Petty Officer Miller's bravery rose above and beyond the call of duty by leaving the laundry and aiding the mortally wounded captain of the ship, and then manning a 50 caliber anti-aircraft machine gun.
Miller later died in 1943 at the age of 24 after the ship he was stationed on sank from a torpedo strike. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
Halliburton announced today that it generated about $22 billion in revenue last year. That's a 7% drop from 2018 for the Houston-based oilfield service company. On a conference call this morning, CEO Jeff Miller drilled down into how the company fared during the fourth quarter of 2019.
While our North America business declined due to the significantly lower activity in U.S. land, internationally we delivered 10% revenue growth this quarter. This underscores the versatility and global reach of our business.
I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Dallas-based communications giant AT&T is in the middle of what appears to be something of a censorship tug of war. This after AT&T complied with embattled Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's request some time ago to stop broadcasting CNN and BBC on its DirecTV service. The State Department wanted to have a word or two with AT&T. According to an exclusive by Josh Goodman, he is a Latin American correspondent for the Associated Press. Joshua, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you very much for having me.
What exactly is it that the State Department seems to be upset with AT&T over?
Basically, AT&T through DirecTV in Venezuela has to obey by the orders from the Maduro government, a government the U.S. no longer recognizes and is actively trying to remove. And, you know, over the years, the Maduro government has really clamped down on what's seen on the airwaves in Venezuela. So, basically, the U.S. State Department, the Venezuelan opposition are trying to twist AT&T's arm into bringing back a lot of channels that have been removed from the airwaves in recent years. We're talking about a half dozen international news channels that really fill a void because there's not a lot of independent local news broadcast. There's a whole number of news channels that Americans won't know, but that are run out of Colombia, Chile, Argentina. And they do, because it's a big issue in the region, dedicate, you know, every day a bit of their programming to Venezuela. And those are the channels that really irritate the Maduro government more than anything else.
But I want to get back to what exactly it is that the State Department wants AT&T to do, because this sounds a bit like a Cold War strategy of kind of trying to leverage American private companies to do a little bit of the, I don't want to say propaganda work of the U.S. government, but to get the U.S. message across in places where the United States couldn't actually speak directly.
The issue here is, you know, the U.S. isn't going to be producing any content. You know, we saw that in Europe and in Cuba a lot. But this, what they're basically asking AT&T to do is just to bring back channels that, you know, most other Latin Americans and Americans would just flip through. These were things that were taken for granted by Venezuelans until very recently. And what's unique about AT&T's platform in Venezuela is they reach 2 million homes. You're talking about, you know, their biggest market share in the world, something like 44% of the pay TV market in Venezuela is controlled by DirecTV.
Why would DirecTV give in to the Maduro government to begin with? Why would it voluntarily remove these channels?
Well, I think they would say they probably, you know, they don't voluntarily remove it. They are quite pressured to do so. I was speaking to some people in the industry in Venezuela, and basically, you know, when the order comes to remove a channel from the air, it's pretty quick. They threaten you over the phone, and in some instances, I think in the case of DirecTV, twice, they sent security forces out to their installations. So this is, DirecTV clearly would say they are not doing this willingly.
If that's the case, then what effect does a State Department request have on DirecTV? Well, I mean, if you work for AT&T, you say, look, they could do any number of things to quash our services there in Venezuela if we decide to reinstate these channels.
So that's 100% correct. I mean, they very much would expect to lose their license if they were to obey the orders of the State Department and be seen as somehow doing the bidding of the U.S. government and the Venezuelan opposition. However, like I explained, they really can, if they wanted to, leave the country and still continue to beam in their content. It would be sort of like a pirated service, if you will. And there's precedent for this. This is something that, you know, DirecTV did in Cuba in 2006, unwittingly so. But basically, the U.S. government bought airtime on a Miami broadcaster to broadcast basically, you know, pro-American coverage. And this was all transmitted to Cuba on DirecTV. There is no DirecTV service in Cuba. They don't have an office there or anything, but I understand there is a little bit of a pirated trade in dishes, and people were able to see, I don't know how many, but it is technologically possible. And the other thing that has to be remembered is, you know, AT&T is not making money in Venezuela. They basically give away their service about for 15 cents a month. This is because of the tragedy of the Venezuelan economy. So the incentive to stay in the minds of the people who are promoting this project is quite minimal.
Joshua, we're out of time, but I have to ask, since I haven't yet, what's the next shoe to drop here?
I suspect that there's going to be a more concerted effort in the coming days and weeks by the Venezuelan opposition. They control the National Assembly, and they issue resolutions and laws that our U.S. government recognizes. I think if they want to really force this issue, they will pass a resolution creating their own framework for broadcast providers, and DirecTV then is going to have to choose. Does it listen to the Maduro government or obey what the U.S. sees as the only democratic institution left in Venezuela?
Joshua Goodman is a Latin America correspondent for the Associated Press. Joshua, thanks again.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose research has helped bring more than 90 cancer-fighting drugs to the marketplace. Patients can access national clinical trials phases 1 through 4 in their communities. More at texasoncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
I was born at the end of the World War II. My father was a contractor with the Japanese Army in northern part of China. Then spring of 1945, we came back for a visit to Hiroshima, Japan. And before too long, August 6 came, and the first in the morning, atomic bomb exploded. We lost everything, there's nothing left. The surviving after post-war Japan was very difficult. Every household have a suicide incident. And I was good at attending a funeral because I attend so many funerals. And I was told, we don't see any plants grow 75 years after atomic bomb. But when I became school age, my science teacher started building a garden. It was the most precious place for me. In 1970, I got married to an American citizen, so I came from Japan. I have a lot of fear, anxiety, uncertainty. So I give myself a present to heal. It's strange when I look back. This is the country we fought, Japan fought. This is the country who dropped the bomb. But also this is the country who helped me. As I get older, my time is every day is a bonus day. Today, my place is a place where my science teacher showed us. I can hear the birds, I can smell the flowers and fresh air. Squirrels visit me, and I appreciate that. My My name is Chicago Nichols. You are listening Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be a force for the greater good. Stories of TCU faculty, student, and alumni changemakers can be explored online at leadon.tcu.edu.
For a quarter century, Emmanuel Borok was concertmaster of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. With his 400-year-old violin, he helped the orchestra tune before each performance. Borok passed away January 4th. He was 75. KERA contributor Quinn Matthews interviewed Borok several times. Matthews now shares this remembrance of the artist and his instrument.
Violinist Emmanuel Borok's life was a pilgrimage about art, a violin, and a lifelong pursuit of beauty. For 25 years, Borok was the concertmaster, the lead violinist of the Dallas Symphony. Most friends called him Manny, but he was usually Emmanuel to me because he had such a formal bearing. Borok's musical career began when he was a child in Riga, Latvia. In the competitive arena of Russian violin, he rose quickly.
I had experience playing in professional orchestras just one season prior to landing in a very prestigious seat in the Moscow Philharmonic Orchestra, namely the second concertmaster, which meant I was second chair in the orchestra.
But Russia couldn't hold him.
All I wanted to get out of there. I just didn't want to live in Russia. I wanted to live in a free world. I applied for a visa to emigrate to Israel, and there I became a persona non grata.
By a unanimous vote, Borok's colleagues, his friends, expelled him from the orchestra.
When I came to America, interestingly enough, I had 30 cents in my pocket. That's all I had to my name.
He got not just a job, but the prestigious position of associate concertmaster in the Boston Symphony. But he was lacking something his new colleagues had.
I realized that I need a fine instrument to join the ranks of my colleagues in the Boston Symphony. So I started my search for a violin. It took me about 2 years and about 200 violins until I came upon this one.
In his studio in Dallas, he opens a violin case and pulls back a soft velvet covering.
That is the Amati, made by two brothers, Antonio and Hieronymus, in 1608 in Cremona, Italy. I've had this violin since 1976. It's the best violin I've ever owned, best violin I will ever own. It's been with me through challenges, concerts I've played on it. It's part of my life. It's inseparable, in a way, from who I am. The fact that it comes from Italy, which I love so much, and the fact that it was made in Cremona, you put all these things together and it says it to me, ah, what a wonderful thing it would be to take it back and to have a concert there and play it for the people.
He got his chance. In 2008, in Cremona, an enthusiastic audience welcomes home a 400-year-old violin and its kindred spirit on his own journey.
We always like to say the violin has a soul. We like to believe that, and the more we believe that, the deeper our relationship is with our instruments is.
In the courtyard of a palazzo in Cremona, Borok brings alive an adagio by Bach, who wasn't born until 70 years after this violin was made. In his teaching and performing, Emmanuel Borok brought passion and beauty to his adopted city of Dallas. I'm Quinn Matthews.
A memorial service for Emmanuel Borok will be held February 15th at the Meyerson Symphony Center in Dallas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
We are fast approaching 10. Well, wait a minute. It's going to be 49 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. We got the Texas, well, talk of Texas coming up in just a couple of minutes. Reach out to us on social media and let us know what's making news in your part of the Lone Star State. Hey, it's Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In the wake of the Sandy Hook mass shooting in 2012, bereaved families sued gun manufacturer Remington Arms. After 5 years of delays, that lawsuit is now moving forward. As Guns in America's Ryan Lindsay reports, the case could offer a window into how the gun industry thinks and operates.
A survivor and nine families whose loved ones died in the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School have been trying to hold Remington accountable. They allege that the company irresponsibly marketed an AR-15-style rifle by using military-inspired imagery and rhetoric that talked about fighting enemies and carrying out missions. Despite years in and out of court, the families haven't given up. Here's their attorney, Josh Koskoff.
It really is a testament and stands for the perseverance of the families I represent who undertook this lawsuit knowing full well that it was going to be a battle.
Remington did not respond to requests for comment. They've argued that the claims against them don't violate federal or state statutes. In late 2019, the U.S. Supreme Court declined Remington's appeal to block the lawsuit. Now the case is slated to be in a Connecticut court in 2021. Koskoff says their lawsuit shows just how much a federal law continues to shield gun companies from liability.
In a way, it's a testament to the strength of their immunity statute that this is a notable exception.
The statute Koskoff is talking about is a federal law called PLACA. The Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act generally prevents most victims and survivors of gun violence from suing gun companies.
The difference with the gun industry is that every other industry has been answerable in a court of law and had to fork over documents that they weren't happy about forking over.
Take the tobacco industry, for example. After years of legal battles, tobacco companies were forced to hand over millions of documents that showed they knew the dangers of smoking.
I think we can see that tobacco playbook in general being deployed by the gun industry. And in this litigation, there may well be documents that show or shed light on the role of an individual corporation.
That's Lisa Graves with the Center for Media and Democracy, a corporate watchdog and consumer advocacy organization. She's been tracking the tobacco and gun industry since the 1990s. And she says, unlike the tobacco industry, the gun industry has never been forced to make public what it considers private.
I don't think that they should be able to rest behind defenses that, you know, they're not responsible at all for how their product is used, especially when it's used specifically, in essence, as designed.
The tobacco playbook Graves mentioned is being used by both sides. Remington is fighting hard in court, and the families allege that Remington's marketing enticed people like the Sandy Hook shooter, who was already obsessed with violence. Connecticut's Unfair Trade Practices Act does not allow business practices that are, quote, immoral, unethical, oppressive, or unscrupulous. That criteria was adopted from cigarette regulations. The next step in figuring out if that allegation holds is what's called discovery, when lawyers for both sides gather information in preparation for a trial.
The discovery process itself may reveal details about the process of gun designs and marketing and sales and distribution that is right now proprietary and not well known or appreciated by regulators.
That's Timothy Litton, a law professor at Georgia State University. He says this case is not just about who wins or loses.
The litigation is likely to put pressure on gun manufacturers, even if Remington wins, to think about maybe altering their designs and some of their marketing techniques and their distribution practices.
The plaintiffs plan to request internal emails, marketing plans, documents, as much as they possibly can from Remington. And they plan to get depositions from decision makers at the company, people who said yes, who design marketing campaigns, who may have known the risks. Litton has some ideas about what could happen if that information comes out.
And it might have a marginal effect in reducing, for example, the lethality of new weapons that are being designed or the risk of illegal straw purchases through controls in the supply chain, and also the promotion of a culture that tends to glorify gun violence in certain segments of the market.
Discovery is not a quick process, but leading up to the 2021 trial date, the families could finally get what they've been looking for. Answers. For Guns and America, I'm Ryan Lindsay.
Guns in America and our partners at KERA North Texas are spending a couple of years reporting on the role of guns in American life. You can learn more yourself at gunsandamerica.org. And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Hey, let's find out what's happening on social media statewide. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Howdy.
Hello there, Wells.
David, good to see you.
Good to see you.
Our friends and listeners appear very intrigued by the question of judicial elections and whether Texas should continue its tradition of deciding judges at the ballot box.
Uh-huh.
We were talking about this earlier in the program with the Texas Tribune's Ross Ramsey.
Did you say they're confused on this issue? Or
intrigued.
That they're
a lot
intrigued.
Of opinions.
Okay,
lots of feedback on this one. On our Facebook page, Randy Smith says, electing the judiciary is a terrible idea. It's really hard to be seen as impartial when you have to run for re-election. However, Edward Eichinger, he says that people need to be involved in the process of elections. It's tempting to give this unique power to others, but still in local county and district elections, voting for judges is the best way. And via Twitter, Becca Congdon, she says, it makes me sad that some think it is better to limit options on the ballot rather than encouraging and assisting in educating voters. We have thousands of flavors of ice cream. We should not limit or pigeonhole political positions just because the ballot is long. And, you know, I think that was one of the things that came up, the sort of, you know, the down ballot nature of it and maybe people not feeling as up to snuff as they should when it comes to voting on those sorts of matters.
It's interesting because there's a scholar from Harvard University who's done some intensive research on this very subject, and he has found that the fairest way is a kind of a hybrid, where, for instance, you have the judge first appointed, and then that judge, at the end of a certain time specific, has to run for election.
Intriguing.
That seems to give the fairest outcomes. Of course, I guess it depends on your inputs for what is fairest and that sort of thing. But in any event, it's
and we have seen some other
case.
People, chiming in on another aspect here, the fact that this sort of this is being floated at the same time. Maybe the political hegemony, if you will, of the Republican Party in Texas is waning somewhat, and so this question of whether or not it could be appointed by someone like the governor, who of course remains Republican, the sort of politics of it continuing to come in.
I certainly understand how that might.
Well, speaking of politics, the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump gets underway today, midday, with a debate over rules and more. And the hours are going to be somewhat unique here, not starting until noon and expected to go well into the evening. Owing to those late hours, on our Facebook page, Bonnie Owen asks, do you know how old many of these senators are and how unused to working these late hours they are? Goodness. And we are hearing lots of people chiming in, too, about the irregular hours there. So many people on Twitter positing that this is part of a plan, if you will, by the Senate to keep fewer
eyes
them. On this topic.
Is that the idea?
This,
just wear people down. Just wear them out.
Yeah.
That's the
rope-a-dope, if you will, I guess, there. This debate over rules expected to dominate primarily this question of whether witnesses will be allowed to testify. Also via Facebook, Steve Bridges, he says that having a trial without allowing witnesses is like playing a football game with no players on the field, only the coaches on the sidelines. What's the point? I guess we will find out the point sooner or later when things do roll around. I imagine there will be plenty of continuing coverage on this NPR station and other ones around the state.
Something tells me we're not going to know the point even then.
No.
I have a hunch we're going to be debating this for quite some time.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, we're out of time for big broadcast, but the news continues over at TexasStandard.O to the R to the G. And we're going to be back here on the radio tomorrow. Till then, I'm David Brown along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard crew wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.